Hi, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of All Crime, No Cattle. I am Shay.
And I'm Erin.
Yeah, and so we've been looking forward to putting out this part two to our Amber Hagerman series. I had some health issues that kind of put us back a little bit, and we had some other things come up, but I'm good, we're good, we're here, ready, willing, and able. So why don't you tell everybody what we have going for, Erin?
Yeah, thank you all so much for tuning in to part two of the story. Please be sure to listen to part one for the details of Amber's abduction and her death. But in summary, on January 13th, 1996, 9-year-old Amber was with her 5-year-old brother Ricky and their mother Donna, who was about 27 at the time, at the kids' grandparents' house in Arlington, Texas. Amber and Ricky asked to go for a quick bike ride, and the kids headed to a nearby parking lot to play. Ricky rode his bike back to his grandparents' house after just a few minutes, but Amber decided to stay behind. A few moments later, a black truck pulled up behind Amber. A man got out, picked her up from the bicycle, and carried her to the truck, where he put her inside and took off. The truck headed in the opposite direction one would most likely take to get to any of the three nearby highways and head out of the city. Instead, it headed towards downtown Arlington. Despite everyone's best efforts in locating Amber safely, her body was found just 4 days later in a creek bed near an apartment complex about 4 miles north of where she was last seen alive. Today we'll be focusing on the aftermath of Amber's death and the reason why she is often referred to as Arlington's little angel or Arlington's little child or a guardian angel of missing children. The immediate aftermath for Amber's family was excruciating, but fortunately Amber's mother Donna and her father Richard were both able to get their wish to see and touch Amber before she was buried, which was reportedly very comforting to them. Amber's wake was held on Friday and her funeral on Saturday, January 20th, at the First United Methodist Church of Arlington. She wore a pink satin dress and she had her arms around a teddy bear as she laid in her blue casket. She was surrounded by pink flowers. Remember, that was her favorite color.
Yeah, I think you mentioned her favorite color in the first part. That was the same color as her bicycle, I believe. And wow, that's just a really sad, somber scene that you just painted for us.
Yeah. It took 2 weeks before Donna and Ricky returned to their apartment for the first time without Amber. The Whitsons' home, that would be Donna and Glenda Whitson, who were Amber's grandparents, it sort of became the headquarters of everything during the investigation and the aftermath. The whole family was together there. That's where they talked to the media in their front yard. That's where they would take phone calls or watch the news coverage of the investigation. And it's also where law enforcement would go to speak privately with the family. The WFAA crew was also spending a significant amount of time with the family at the house as well.
So it was kind of like the epicenter for everything going on with this case and the story of Amber Hagerman.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it was something that was really reassuring for the whole family to be together during this incredibly traumatic event.
Oh, yeah, I can imagine.
But finally, 2 weeks after Amber's funeral, Donna and Ricky would have to return home and face their new reality without Amber. The film crew went with them and ended up filming Donna discovering all of these reminders of Amber. There was her backpack next to the couch with a little baggie of her newest brownie patches that she just earned. There was an incomplete puzzle that Amber had been working on the table in the living room. And Donna really broke down when they entered Amber's bedroom and began looking through her toys, her awards scrapbook, the Pocahontas bed sheets that Donna had scrimped and saved for her 9th birthday. Yeah. And in fact, Donna would leave Amber's room almost exactly the same for years, in fact.
Man, you hear about those stories where it's kind of like a time capsule, you know, you're like holding on to it, to a time that was before all of this stuff happened.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, I can't even imagine.
And while mourning the loss of one child, Donna still had to care for Ricky. Now, obviously, Ricky himself was extremely confused and scared about what happened, and he started displaying some behavioral problems as well. Donna took him in for counseling, where eventually Ricky admitted that he felt a tremendous amount of guilt over what happened to Amber. Not that he understood it, because obviously he didn't. All he knew was that Amber was taken by a bad man. But he said that he thought it was his fault because he had left Amber alone in that Winn-Dixie parking lot that day. So this is a 5 or 6 year old boy blaming himself for the death of his sister.
Yeah, survivor's guilt, right?
Yeah, at five. I mean, it's just
you have to grow up with that.
Yes.
Carried around with you. And you're at such a sensitive age, too, at 5 years old, where he's starting to move forward with his life. And now you don't have a sister and you have all this survivor's guilt. That's awful.
Oh, I know. It's awful. About a month after Amber's death, her elementary school, Barry Elementary, hosted a special day of remembrance for her, with Amber's family as the honored guests. There was a dedication ceremony wherein the playground at the school was renamed Amber's Playground, and Amber's third grade classmates sang a song in her memory. Donna visited Amber's classroom, where the children had set up what they called an Amber Museum, with pictures and items that reminded them of her. The children in Amber's class were obviously all affected to what had happened to their classmate. And they were given time to ask questions to Donna about what happened to Amber.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. And Donna very kindly answered their questions, obviously at the age-appropriate level. And I think this whole thing was supposed to help heal the community and be for the children who knew Amber. So it was kind of for them. But at the end of this discussion with Donna, the kids actually started consoling her.
Wow.
Telling her how pretty and nice Amber was, and how she was a good friend, everything like that. So the kids actually started consoling her, telling her how pretty and nice Amber was and how she was a good friend, things like that.
Wow. That has got to be hard for Donna to do that.
Yeah.
And that shows her strength to be able to go in there and help these kids out, even though she's struggling and hurting too.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Donna is an incredible woman, and we're going to be talking a lot more about her.
Good. She sounds amazing.
Yeah. About a month after Amber's celebration at school, Donna took Amber's place in the bridging ceremony that would have graduated her from a Brownie to a Junior Girl Scout. We talked last episode about how excited Amber was for the ceremony. Donna crossed the bridge and received Amber's new Girl Scout uniform and was sworn in Amber's place. And she did this, of course, alongside the other girls in Amber's troop, most of whom were Amber's best friends. So, I mean, just absolutely heartrending, the whole thing, but so special, I think, for Donna.
Definitely, but you're going to make me cry. You're pulling on the heartstrings for sure.
I feel you. I feel like I've cried so much over this case because it is just so tragic. And as for Donna herself, she picked up the pieces and moved on as best she could for the benefit of Ricky, most of all. After taking only just a couple of weeks off, she returned to the medical assisting training program that she'd just begun in the fall of 1995. She went on to complete the program, moving on after that to get the steady, well-paying job with benefits that she'd always dreamed about, that stability.
Oh, nice. Good for her.
The WFAA documentary team continued to film Donna and the rest of Amber's family throughout the wake of Amber's death. As we talked about in episode one, the team, which featured reporter Pam Curry and photographers John Doty and Paul Parisot, had been tasked to create a television program centering around Donna and her struggle to raise two children as a single mother on welfare. The team spent 8 weeks with the family at the end of 1995, and the episode was set to air on January 18, 1996. After Amber's disappearance, the TV special was scrapped, but the same team stayed on to provide continued support for Donna and Ricky. And that included continuing to film very private moments of personal grief, which provided the family a platform to express their grief in a very therapeutic way, I think.
Wow, that seems very rare for this to be an option and be able to happen.
Oh, absolutely. Now, years later in 2016, Pam Curry was asked in a WFAA interview why she thought Donna and the others would choose to participate. And she said, quote, "I think she wanted people to know how horrible this is for a parent to go through and what happens. And unfortunately, she's still living that as far as still not knowing what happened to Amber." Donna, Ricky, Jimmy, Glinda, and the rest of Amber's family wanted people to see the reality of what they were living through as the living victims of a tragedy this powerful.
Wow, that's incredible. I can't believe that all happened.
Yeah. And so, on January 13th, 1997, 1 year to the day after Amber's abduction, WFAA released the documentary called After Amber, filmed and produced by the same three members of the documentary film that had been set to film that original story just 2 months before Amber's death. I've mentioned it several times at this point, and that's because the film, in my opinion, is beautiful. It included all of the footage of Amber taken before her abduction for the original TV show, clips of her talking about school, showing off the awards she won, making dinner with her mother and brother, her 9th birthday party, all of these windows into Amber's life. It also showed the parts filmed about Donna and her going back to school, being on welfare, struggling to get by while raising 2 children. And it followed Donna and the rest of Amber's family in the days after Amber's abduction, as they busied themselves with media pleas and statements, went on searches for Amber or passed out flyers, and waited in agony for news of her whereabouts. And they were filming during the moments where they came to find out and finally accept that Amber was gone. It includes more footage and interviews with the family throughout the months after Amber's funeral as they begin to slowly acknowledge what their lives will be like after Amber, and it allowed a victim's family to actively participate in the telling of her story, which isn't something that happens a lot. So it helped to create probably, in my opinion at least, the most moving tribute to a victim of crime that I've ever seen.
Yeah. That's one of our things when we're researching a case and looking into it. These moments that they captured as a part of this documentary, especially in the aftermath, so much of that coverage is never talked about when a child goes missing or someone is murdered and there's a tragic uncertainty or a death. And it sounds super rare, unique, and I can't believe it happened. And I'm definitely going to go check it out.
Yeah, I highly recommend watching it. You can find it on their website or on YouTube. Again, beware, it is brutal. I think I wept through the entire film. Aww. But there's honestly just nothing like it because of the strange coincidence of the close emotional bond the family had already happened to have. Because of the very strange coincidence of the close emotional bond the family had already happened to have established with this local documentary team. It's just wild.
It seems like they became very intimate and close and supportive, and it seemed in the best intentions and very good-natured.
Yeah, absolutely. Arlington residents demonstrated an outpouring of love and support for Amber and her family. We talked last time about volunteers for search parties and for passing out flyers, and Arlington residents attending vigils for Amber. A local artist donated a sculpture of an angel to display near the abduction site too, and there were a lot of pieces of art and memorials set up by the people of Arlington for Amber. And her case went national, and that was really fueled by all of the excellent media maneuvering that the family was doing, plus all the footage of the loving family that WFAA had released just after Amber was kidnapped. People from all over the country sent hundreds of letters of sympathy and support to Donna and the family, including gifts and trinkets in memory of Amber. Donna ended up receiving so many stuffed animals that she donated hundreds of them to the same women's shelter that she had lived at with Ricky and Amber.
Oh, God, that is, I mean, it's amazing that she did that, but it's also at the same time so heartbreaking.
Absolutely. Yeah, I know. Now, and after Amber, Pam Curry suggests that without a suspect in Amber's murder to focus their attention on, Amber's family turned their focus instead on strengthening laws against all sex offenders. And even before Amber's body had been found, Donna had been quite outspoken in the media decrying sexual predators, especially those who prey on children. Soon after, Donna and Richard began working together in their advocacy for their daughter and for other missing and murdered children. They founded the group People Against Sex Offenders, with its initial and primary goal to pressure Texas' legislature to pass more stringent laws against sex offenders. Richard took over as the lead of the organization, and they pretty much relied on donations of office space and supplies from churches and local businesses. So this was a very grassroots operation. PASO began collecting signatures and getting a lot of coverage in the press, and a lot of public support. One of those supporters was Mark Class, the father of Polly Class, the 12-year-old little girl from Petaluma, California, who was abducted from a slumber party and killed in 1993. Just like Donna and Richard, Mark had become a very well-known child advocate, and he frequently reached out to offer support to other families of missing and murdered children. And he did in this case, too. In fact, along with Congressman Mark Frost, he helped PASO draft the Amber Hagerman Child Protection Bill. this bill introduced additional penalties for the sexual abuse of children under the age of 16. But more importantly, it would allow the FBI to create and maintain a national sex offender database.
Oh, okay. I can see where this is going. I didn't realize this is where the roots were. All right.
Exactly. Donna and Richard both testified in front of Congress at the House Judiciary Committee in June of 1996 in support of the bill, where they recounted Amber's story. And in October, the Amber Hagerman Child Protection Act was signed into law by then-President Bill Clinton, officially creating the National Sex Offender Registry. So that this is actually where it came from.
Ah, okay.
Donna and Richard stood by the president as he signed the bill, and Donna was gifted the pen Bill Clinton used to sign the bill into law. Amber's murder was horrific and sad and unfair, and it prompted a lot of community gatherings and city council meetings held directly in reaction to Amber's murder, especially the very real fear that her murderer was still out there living in the city. And so many listeners have left comments on our post or have reached out with their personal stories of how Amber's case affected them personally, how parents in Arlington were afraid to let their kids ride their bikes around or even play outside.
Yeah, there were several comments on the main discussion thread that we posted on our group page.
Yeah, and on Instagram and other places as well.
It really touched a lot of people.
It did. And while Donna and Richard were really focusing on Paso and getting this bill passed, simultaneously, the community of North Texas was also rising up and asking, how can we learn from this tragedy and what can we do to prevent it in the future? And as we'll see, this reaction had a ripple effect that would end up influencing people and even law enforcement agencies and governments of countries around the world.
Oh, wow. So it goes global.
Oh, yeah. It all began right after Amber's abduction in January of 1996. A massage therapist from Fort Worth named Diana Simone heard the story and lamented that if people around Arlington had been on the lookout for this black truck or this missing little girl, she might have been recovered. By this time, the emergency alert system was already in place. That's the national public warning system that disseminates alerts regarding things like natural disasters, weather alerts, and national emergencies. Back in those days, the warnings were dispersed to the public primarily through TV and radio alerts.
Yeah, we've all heard them break in and be like, this is a test for the national broadcast emergency alert system.
Exactly. Well, Diana wondered if the system could be adapted to alert the public in cases of abducted children like Amber as well. On January 19th, she called the Dallas-Fort Worth-based radio station KDMX 102.9 and mentioned the idea to the station manager. She also followed up that phone call with a letter that was later released by the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. In the letter, Diana mused, quote, I would like to suggest an emergency system be set up so that when a verified 911 call is placed, all the radio stations in the area would be notified immediately and they would interrupt programming to broadcast an emergency alert, giving whatever information and descriptions that are pertinent. In this way, thousands of people would be alerted within minutes of an occurrence, greatly minimizing the chance of successful escape. I sincerely hope this plan or something similar can be enacted so children of the Dallas-Fort Worth area may experience their childhood as a time of joy rather than as one of fear and apprehension.
Yeah, it sounds like a great epiphany of a new idea with existing technology that could really be used to start something to be super helpful for the future.
Yeah, exactly. And let's be clear here. Diana basically just described what we now know as the Amber Alert system before it was ever the Amber Alert system. And the final line of her letter wrote, quote, if you are able to gather support for this emergency broadcast plan, my one request is that it be known as Amber's plan. The radio station, in turn, brought the idea to the Dallas-Fort Worth Association of Radio Managers, who then teamed up with dozens of local television stations and law enforcement agencies to discuss the logistics of such a large undertaking. They settled on two criteria for issuing an alert. The child must be 17 years of age or younger, and police must believe the child is in danger of bodily harm or death. In those cases, the law enforcement agencies participating in the alert system would send the information to one of two primary radio stations in the DFW area, including the child's name, picture, and other identifying information. Those stations were tasked to confirm all of the information and then send it along to participating radio and television stations in the area, who agreed that they would cut into their regularly scheduled programming with the alert. This system was eventually called the Dallas Amber Plan, and it was officially adopted in the North Texas area in 1997.
Wow, so initially it wasn't called the Amber Alert System.
That's right. We're going to get to the development of the Amber Alert System, the national plan. But yeah, this is something that started right here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area.
Yeah, so it's kind of a small community-based effort kind of thing that expands out and gradually grows and grows and grows to become what we know of it today as the Amber Alert System.
Yes, that is correct. So the Amber Alert started as the Dallas Amber Plan right here in North Texas. In 1998, the Dallas Amber Plan had its first success story. An 8-week-old girl named Raylee Bradbury was abducted by her babysitter in Arlington, the same city as Amber. An alert was issued to the public that included the kidnapper's vehicle description, which was a turquoise pickup truck. Within 90 minutes of the release of the alert, someone contacted law enforcement saying they had spotted the pickup truck, and law enforcement arrived to find the baby inside the truck, and she was safely recovered. So this was the first case with definitive proof that the child was recovered directly as a result from a public tip from this new alert system.
All right, we've got a proof of concept here.
Exactly. Now, Raylee Bradbury has since grown up, and she has been a very passionate proponent of the Dallas Amber Plan and the later Amber Alert System ever since.
Oh, wow. So she's still involved with it or still an advocate for it?
Just kind of an advocate, someone who is sometimes questioned about it, and she'll give her thoughts about it as someone who had it directly affect her life in a positive way.
Yeah, I can imagine. If it saved your life, you would be a part of this program.
Oh, yeah.
Moving forward for real.
Mm-hmm. Especially after the system started actually getting real results, the Dallas Amber Plan was taken to the U.S. Justice Department and the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, NCMEC, with the objective of developing a national initiative.
Okay, so we're getting national recognition now.
That's right. The NCMEC is a private nonprofit agency that was founded by John and Reveille Walsh back in 1984, 3 years after their son Adam Walsh went missing.
Hold up a second. Is this John Walsh from America's Most Wanted Walsh family? Is this
yes.
the same?
Yes. So one of the multiple things that John and Reveille have done over the years for in their advocacy work for victims of crime, especially child victims of crime, we know that he did America's Most Wanted.
Yeah, he was the host.
That's right. But they also founded the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children.
Yeah, they've talked about that on the show. And it's interesting to see these two avenues coming together for the same purpose.
Yeah. Well, it's also interesting seeing how all of these different family members of victimized children are relating to each other after the fact as well. You know, we Definitely. Talked about Mark Klass, for example. It is very interesting, the phenomenon of having family members become such advocates when something bad happens to their children.
Yeah, and this whole case seems to be a snowball that's picking up these advocates who are related to victims, family members who are so passionate about this cause that it's just building, building, building and moving forward. It's kind of interesting to see it develop.
Yeah, absolutely. So as we know, under the new national initiative, the program became known as the Amber Alert. Amber's name was used to develop the backronym for the name of the program. So as we know, an acronym is a word that is formed from the first letters of a phrase. Well, a backronym is the opposite, where the phrase is created to fit the letters of the already existing word. So for example, Amber in the Amber Alert System actually stands for America's Missing Broadcast Emergency Response.
Oh.
So that's why whenever you see the term Amber Alert in print, Amber is always in all caps.
Wow, I didn't realize that.
I didn't realize that either. But yeah, that's the history of where the name comes from.
I'm already thinking about so many backronyms now
that I know.
I've experienced in my life. Okay.
Exactly. And of course, the central objective of the Amber Alert, per its website, is to instantly galvanize communities to assist in the search for and the safe recovery of an abducted child. Today, the Amber Alert system is in operation nationwide with 86 Amber plans throughout the country, with every state participating, as well as the District of Columbia, the U.S. Virgin Islands, and Puerto Rico.
Oh, wow. The extra territories are also doing this.
That's right.
Wow.
And recently, in 2015, the Amber in Indian Country initiative was developed for indigenous communities.
That's so important.
Exactly.
And so awesome, because we know that's an area that needs a program like this.
Yeah.
So many little girls and women go missing from indigenous populations around the United States.
Yeah, exactly. And now we have Amber Alerts that are tailored for those communities.
That's beautiful.
In total, 27 other countries have also adopted the Amber Alert system, and many countries actually work together in the face of an Amber Alert. For example, the U.S., Canada, and Mexico all participate with each other if it's believed that a missing child has been transported across the border. Alerts are disseminated through radio and television stations, text messages, email, electronic billboards, and traffic condition road signs, search engines, social media sites, and we have all participated in this, and we'll get into some of those details more here in a second.
Yeah, it's very complicated and elaborate.
Well, let me explain it to you. Each state or province sets its own criteria regarding how the Amber Alert is activated within its geographic area. So the specifics of how the Amber Alert is carried out varies from place to place. But there is a general set of rules set down by the Justice Department that most states act in accordance with. Put simply, the guidelines to issuing an Amber Alert are as follows. Law enforcement must confirm that an abduction of a child under 17 has indeed occurred, that the abducted child is in serious risk of injury or death, and that there is enough descriptive information about the child, the abductor, or the abductor's vehicle to form the basis of the alert.
So some of those principles kind of come directly out of the original Amber plan.
Yes. Those okay. First two especially are basically exactly how the Dallas Amber plan functioned. And as an aside, we're focusing specifically on stranger abduction here because that's what happened to Amber Hagerman. But other types of missing children cases can also trigger an Amber Alert.
Yeah, like familial abduction.
That's right. So, for example, if a child is believed to be lost or injured, or there might be a case of an endangered runaway, children missing on their own accord, but their family doesn't know where they are. And like you said, cases in which children are abducted by family members can also trigger alerts, again, if it's believed that the child is in risk of danger. And in fact, stranger abduction cases are statistically extremely rare when compared to some of the other reasons why a child could be deemed missing and in danger. Now, all of these guidelines are in order to prevent alerts from being issued flippantly, that very important steps have been followed so that the public remains confident in the system. It also helps to ensure that Amber Alerts are triggered only in serious cases where there is ample reason to believe the child is in danger, and not preemptively. Obviously, law enforcement should assess each situation individually to corroborate that the child is missing and in danger, to avoid sending out alerts in cases where the explanation is something like a simple custodial issue between family members.
Yeah, and I think confidence in the system, like you said, is the most important part, because you don't want a system like this that's so complicated, so technologically advanced, to fall apart because people just don't believe in it, because they're like, oh, is this like a weird situation where this child isn't missing or, you know, not in trouble? You know, you need it to be concrete. It needs to be an emergency and everybody needs to be on the lookout. Trust in the system.
You're exactly right. So there's this balance between wanting to send an alert out as quickly as possible because you want people looking for this child, and making sure that you have enough information to go on to confirm that there isn't an innocuous reason that a child is missing.
Exactly.
Yeah. And sometimes those things take time. But in the right circumstances, today these alerts can be issued within minutes if deemed necessary. Which brings us all the way back to Amber's abduction specifically. Within seconds, it was reported to the police by an eyewitness who observed the entire event and provide a description of the missing child, along with descriptions of the assailant and his getaway vehicle. And minutes after the 911 call, Jimmy, Amber's grandfather, arrived at the scene, and the family was alerted. So they then had the child's name, a detailed description of what she looked like and what she was wearing. They even had photographs of her. Amber's case ticks every box when it comes to a modern-day Amber Alert. And that's what's always been the question. If this system had been in place when Amber was abducted, and the alert went out to the people of Arlington within minutes of when she was taken, would that have made the difference?
I think so. I mean, like you said before, he didn't go to a major highway, which would put him at high speed moving out of the area. He instead turned and went into the interior, the heart of the city of Arlington, where there would have been so many people, stoplights, things to slow him down, people to see him. What if everyone had a smartphone back then and got the alert and knew the type of vehicle, knew what they were looking for? I bet she would have been saved.
And this happened on a Saturday afternoon, 3 p.m. It was a busy road.
Broad daylight, yeah.
Broad daylight. So it's very feasible that there were opportunities for people to have seen her sometime after she was abducted. Now, once a case meets all of these criteria and law enforcement is satisfied that the alert will help locate a missing endangered child, the information is delivered then to all of the TV and radio stations, transportation agencies, all of those entities within a geographic area. Now, local police agencies can issue alerts for their area, but for a national alert to take place, the Department of Public Safety must agree that the case indeed qualifies for an alert at the national level. Now, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children also receives the Amber Alert information, and it further disseminates the alerts to internet service providers, Facebook, Google, Twitter. So that's why you'll see popping up in your social media feeds.
So the Walsh's organization is like doing the social media part of it.
Yeah, really. And they also send it to digital billboard systems, to the trucking industry, amongst other organizations. And according to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, as of December 2020, a total of 1,029 children have been safely recovered with the use of the National Amber Alert System.
Wow.
And I believe that number represents the number of cases where the recovery was a direct result of a public tip.
That is awesome.
Yeah.
It's really, really, really great to see that there's some solid results that are coming out of this program.
100%. And so it's no surprise then that people started calling Amber a kind of guardian angel for other children. And many people refer to the Amber Alert system as Amber Hagerman's legacy.
Yeah, I totally understand that. And that's no wonder why she's also considered Arlington's little angel at this point. There's so much mythos and legacy, like you said, and build up to this. It's so tragic, but also so motivating that something so good could save so many kids.
Yeah.
That comes out of this in the end.
And Donna herself, I think, would agree with you. She said that overall, the Amber Alert system is very bittersweet for her. But she also said, quote, "I'm very proud of it because it is saving our children's lives. It's helped bring children back to mommy and daddy. It's another legacy for my daughter, that she didn't die in vain, that she's still taking care of our little children as she did when she was here. And I'm very proud of my daughter." As far as the full investigation into Amber's death goes, unfortunately, there isn't much more to report beyond what we already talked about in episode one, which by and large were the details they knew back in 1996. No other witnesses have ever come forward with information that has led the investigation anywhere, which is unfortunate because it's hard to believe that someone somewhere doesn't know something that may lead to the suspect's arrest. And in fact, it seems that there really hasn't even been a solid person of interest, and that's not for lack of trying. I mentioned that Amber Hagerman Task Force last episode. That was the team of 12 Arlington detectives who were assigned full-time to solving Amber's murder. Between its inception in February of 1996 and its eventual disbandment in 1997, the team received and cleared 5,500 leads in this case.
That's a lot of leads.
Yeah, and they still weren't any closer to finding her killer. And ever since, Amber's case has remained an open and active investigation, with a total number of cleared leads now at over 7,000, according to the Arlington Police Department. January 13th, 2021, just a few months ago, marked the 25th anniversary of Amber's abduction, and the Arlington Police Department held a press conference to honor Amber's life and to reinvigorate public interest and awareness in this unsolved case. At the press conference, members of the Arlington Police Department broke down her abduction and released pictures of Amber's bicycle, maps of each important location in the case, and the creek bed where Amber's body was found. We reposted all of these photos on our social media with the release of part one, by the way, so you can view them all in one sort of easy post. The officers underlined that to this day, they continue to receive tips in her case more than any other cold case in their department.
Really?
Yeah, that's right. Many of the law enforcement officers who have been involved with Amber's case over the years spoke at this press conference, along with Amber's mother, Donna, and the entire event was held in the exact location where Amber was kidnapped off her bicycle.
Really? Right by that loading ramp?
Yes.
Wow.
Now, surprisingly, the area around that old abandoned Winn-Dixie parking lot looks shockingly similar to what it did back then. The Winn-Dixie is now a La Michoacana meat market. And although the building is a different color today and the doors and awnings around the old delivery ramp look a little different, everything else is the same. That old quick wash laundromat is still there, along with what I believe is the same auto body shop. The line of houses, one of which was the eyewitness Jimmy Kevel's home, are all still there, although Jimmy himself passed away in 2016 at the age of 98.
Oh, wow. Okay, so he lived a long life, but
he did. He served in the Navy in World War II, by the way, I found out. Yeah.
He sounds like a good guy. But no, I remember looking at pictures with you. You were kind of showing me pictures of the scene after part one, and it does still look very eerily similar to the day that this all happened.
Yeah, that's right. And in fact, the biggest difference today is a large mural that has been painted along the low cement wall that lines the south edge of the parking lot. It's a mural of Amber painted onto a bright pink background. Her favorite color, of course, with butterflies and sunflowers and a teddy bear and the words Amber Hagerman, Arlington's little angel. The memorial had been first painted in 2013 and was completely refurbished in 2019 by a local artist who goes by the name of Patch. Now, during this press conference, police once again reinforced the need for eyewitness tips even after all of these years. And they specifically addressed anyone who could have been in the immediate area, this shopping center where the Winn-Dixie was at, the auto body shop, the houses nearby, this entire sort of immediate area around the abduction zone.
And at that quick wash, I'm imagining, because that truck was parked at the quick wash via the description by the eyewitness.
That's right. Their primary focus really seems to be on that laundromat that was located right next to the parking lot and right in front of Jimmy's house. Remember, Jimmy said that he believed he saw the same truck that was used in Amber's abduction pulled up next to the laundromat about 45 minutes before she was taken. So there's a real chance that the person who kidnapped Amber had just been in or at least around that laundromat. The question has always been, does someone know something about this person and perhaps was too scared to come forward? Perhaps, for example, an undocumented person. Mm-hmm. Sergeant Ben Lopez, who once headed Amber's investigation, stated at the press conference that he understood that undocumented people might be fearful of coming forward and speaking to law enforcement, but that they wanted to reassure the community that police had, quote, no interest in their undocumented status, and, quote, if there is a witness or witnesses who have that concern, we are not interested at all in pursuing any kind of deportation.
Well, that's good. They're trying to cover all their bases, and yeah, they shouldn't care about that. And they're just trying to get answers for Amber's case no matter what. So that's good.
Yeah. Donna also spoke at the press conference. She began by saying that she wanted to share the details of Amber's life, that she loved school and riding her bicycle, being a little mommy to her brother. And Donna also spoke about how much she missed Amber. Quote, I remember everything about her. There's nothing I've forgotten about her. She is the love of my life. And to Amber's killer, I'm asking you today, please turn yourself in. Amber needs justice. To anyone else, please come forward. She also added, quote, I just want Amber's killer to know I'm not going anywhere. I'm not going to give up on her. Never. All speakers underlined the importance of any witnesses stepping forward with information, no matter how small. To that end, they provided the most updated tip line. 817-575-8823. There's also a $10,000 reward being offered by Oak Farms Dairy for any information leading to an arrest. Law enforcement has always stressed that the physical evidence in Amber's case is extremely limited, but that there is some kind of trace evidence involved that was first collected back in 1996 and has been held in storage ever since.
Okay, this is something that I wanted to talk to you about because you alluded to it in part one, and I'm very curious. Is this something that may or may not have come from her body when they recovered her body?
That's what it seems, but what the evidence is and where it was found have never been released to the public.
Yeah, and this is the only option that makes sense for me because I can't imagine there's some kind of evidence from where she was grabbed off of her bicycle.
No, yeah, I think this is something that was covered from the scene where they recovered her body, either something from her body or from the surrounding area.
Okay.
Because whatever this item or evidence is essentially the only physical evidence in this investigation, law enforcement has never released the details of the evidence to the public. And they've basically stated that doing so would hurt the investigation.
Sure. They've got like this secret weapon here that they're hoping that technology might be able to advance to some degree to where they can use it.
Yeah.
So you're not going to give it away.
Exactly. If it's your only link to the killer, you're not going to give those details out. But there was a new announcement at this press conference. For the first time, the APD acknowledged that this evidence does contain a limited amount of DNA. For years, both Assistant Chief Kevin Colby, the Assistant Chief over Investigations, and Detective Grant Gildon, the current lead of Amber's homicide investigation, contacted laboratories around the country to see if any new technology had developed that could assist them in getting an enhanced DNA profile from the extremely limited evidence that they had available. And apparently, just recently, there was a big break at the FBI forensic lab. Some kind of newfangled technology that has been developed that they believe could be used on this evidence to attain the killer's DNA profile.
Ooh, exciting.
Yes. Again, there were no specifics of the details of the technology or the evidence itself, but Assistant Chief Colby actually mentioned a time frame for the submission of the evidence. He said, quote, "We haven't submitted our evidence yet. We have previously submitted DNA evidence several times to the FBI laboratory. Because the technology is new and it's advanced, we are excited that this year, and hopefully by February, we will submit this new evidence to see if we can get an enhanced DNA profile." Well, it has been, as you know, now it is May, so it's been a few months from February. And there hadn't been any other sort of official public statements regarding where they are along on this process, if the evidence was submitted to the FBI in February as they hoped.
And so then you got curious and you started asking questions.
I did. So I reached out to Arlington Police Department's Deputy Chief Christopher Cook via email to ask him about it. He responded right away, saying that he, quote, checked with a lead homicide investigator and they indicated that at this stage, the lab has not accepted our submission yet due to the technical aspects involved in the case. Based upon the limited evidence we have left in the case, we have to carefully navigate this with the lab. We are hoping to get this accomplished soon. I also reached out to Detective Gildon, who was the current lead investigator on Amber's case. But as of now, that's the latest news. So if we hear any additional information about where the Arlington Police Department is along the process of submitting this evidence to the FBI lab, we will be sure to keep you all updated in a future episode.
It makes me kind of wonder if they are kind of stuck in a logjam because of this announcement by the FBI labs, that they're somewhere in the system being evaluated for who's going to be tested for this technology, you know, and they have to wait for approval by the FBI. And also, procuring DNA samples sometimes is destructive based on the kind of DNA samples that you're getting. So you have to kind of pick and choose what you're going to submit your DNA samples for and how you're going to use it in the lab because you only have so many of them.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So yeah, it might be kind of a longer process than we sort of originally hoped for, but it does sound like they are still planning on this going down here in the next few months, or at least certainly within the next year, hopefully having this information submitted to the lab. Now, there's a lot of ifs to what I'm about to say, and I don't want to get anyone's hopes up too bad. But if this new technology results in an enhanced DNA profile of Amber's killer, then that profile can then be submitted to a genealogical database, and hopefully the killer can be tracked down that way via a cousin or an uncle or some relative who is in the database.
Oh, yeah, just like the Golden State Killer.
Yeah, that's right. And Scooter and Branham of the Dallas Morning News, amongst others, have pointed out that similar tactics have been used to solve other recent decades-old cases that were also considered unsolvable. For example, the East Area Rapist, just like you said, also known as the original Night Stalker, or the Golden State Killer. Joseph James DeAngelo was caught this way in 2018. And even more recently, in 2020, a suspect named Glenn Samuel McCurley was finally arrested in the 1974 murder of Carla Walker right here in Fort Worth,
yes,
using that same genealogical databases. And if you'd like to hear more about her story, the Gone Cold podcast has told it in full detail. So that's a very good resource for more information about Carla's case. So we are seeing real practical results, and it seems like we're solving very old cold cases left and right nowadays. So we can only hope that something similar can happen in Amber's case as well, and that Amber's case will one day have a resolution.
Yeah, and I'm sure, you know, the FBI, typically when one of these new technologies comes out, a lot of times there's a full public briefing after they start, like, going through cases and getting results, and they come out and tell you how it all works and what they're actually doing. And I'm sure that's coming down the road, too, since there's been this big announcement. They've had a huge break in this DNA technology, so I'm looking forward to it. I think there's a lot of possibilities, and I'm happy for the future to get resolution for some of these families that need it, who've been fighting for so long.
Yeah, I know, so long, 25 years. And that's the thing, though, that's the thing to be happy about, is even though it's been so long, that there is still hope that this case will be solved.
Wow, what a story. And it had so many twists and turns that I was not expecting, knowing the little that I did, that I think a lot of us who are into true crime, we know about the Amber Hagerman case, but we don't really know it. We haven't really gone through it with a fine-tooth comb. And you did, and thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. It was really a fascinating case, and I learned so much. I still can't believe that what we know as the Amber Alert started right here in North Texas. It was a community effort to solve a problem.
Yeah.
And I think that's really beautiful.
Yeah, it was so grassroots in the beginning.
Yeah.
And now it's national, it's international.
Mm-hmm.
It's got all this cooperation, and I'm looking forward to seeing where it goes from here with, you know, the advancement of technology with our cell phones and the internet and social media. I'm sure it's going to get better the more we move forward, and we can solve more crimes, save more people, rescue more kids that need that help.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you. But you know what I'm looking forward to?
What's that?
In this moment, I'm looking forward to your good news story.
Oh. Well, I got a great one.
Excellent. Can't wait for it. And we will get back to that right after this.
You know, Aaron and I work our brains a lot.
Speak for yourself.
Well, I will. And, you know, we research a lot for this case. We do a lot of hard thinking. But sometimes you just need to unplug and challenge your brain in a different way. And that's what I love about Best Fiends. Back when we first discovered this game, it was kind of like chess, where every round is different and you have to find a new way to defeat the slugs and use different strategy and different characters. And that's what I like about it. It's always interesting. It keeps you going. It keeps you second guessing yourself and trying new different tactics.
And I really like all of the cute little characters that you get to play with. Right now, there's a special event going on where if you earn enough gold in the game, you get a new friend to add to your team. His name is Dart, and he's a poison dart frog, and he's very adorable.
I love poison dart frogs. And you know, Aaron, I also saw that there is a baseball theme coming up in the game, which, you know, I love sports. We both love sports, and we got the Texas Rangers here locally, so maybe that'll be fun. So if you're into sports and a game that constantly has new themes and new and different things to explore in the game. It's constantly updating and changing. Take my advice and go out and download Best Fiends.
Download the 5-star rated puzzle game Best Fiends free today on the App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends.
Yeah! This just in, Aaron. There's good news to be had today. Yep, that's right. And even better, it's a story about a turtle.
I love a turtle.
You do love a turtle, don't you? We both love turtles.
Yeah.
It's one of my top three favorite animals, so I was really excited about doing this story. Well, this story comes to us from one of our favorite good news websites, click2houston.com. Just a few weeks ago, a massive alligator snapping turtle was rescued in Houston and was re-released back into the wild to a nearby coastal bayou in the surrounding area. That bayou is Buffalo Bayou. The reason why this is special is twofold, really. First, alligator snapping turtles' numbers have been drastically dwindling in the Houston estuaries for the past several decades due to habitat loss, pollution, and hunting. Yeah, a lot of people hunt alligator snapping turtles for their meat or because they're pests.
Oh, that's sad. I don't like that.
Yeah, which, you know, alligator snapping turtles make up a very important part of the environment, the ecosystem, and they're not pests. They've been there for thousands and thousands of years. This trend matches others seen in and around the species' other native habitats. The western alligator snapping turtle is a majestic creature. It is the largest freshwater turtle in the western hemisphere and can attain a size of nearly 200 pounds as well as live to be well beyond 100 years old. We actually don't know how long they can live, but the oldest snapping turtle ever recorded was well over 100 years old.
Wow, 100 years old, 200 pounds. Just working it, living that life.
Them turtles be thick. Sadly, just a few years ago, scientists believed that populations of the western alligator snapping turtle no longer lived in Harris County at all, which had been one of the most populated areas for snapping turtles on the Texas coast.
Wow.
To stop the loss of such an important creature, Texas Parks and Wildlife has been working in conjunction with the Turtles Survival Alliance. They actually began a conservation project for the species in 2016. Since then, they have been able to capture threatened alligator snapping turtles, tag them, and relocate them to the Buffalo Bayou Conservation Area, which today houses over 100 tagged alligator snapping turtles.
Wow.
Yeah, an area that didn't have any of this indigenous species, but now has a healthy population, so that's really cool. Now, to get to what's so special about this turtle that was caught and tagged, which is the whole basis of this story. Well, it was caught with a few other snapping turtles, but this big bad boy was 130 pounds, and he was a male, which is important because males are rare with collections of this species.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so they need more males to be amongst all the other females so they can make babies and have eggs and increase the population, you know, so on and so forth. It was actually the 99th turtle caught by the program, and as a nod to Houston's favorite defensive player, who wore number 99, they named the turtle of beastly size J.J. Watt.
I love that. He was the 99th turtle. And they, yeah. Okay, I love that. That's adorable.
Yeah, and you know,
people of Houston love J.J. Watt, by the way. He's a great guy, as far as I've heard.
And he's done so much for the city. He's raised a lot of money when they've gone through hurricane relief and disaster relief. And he just seems like a dude with a big heart. He hits big on the field, but he also hits big when it comes to conservation and helping the city out and relief efforts. So all around a good guy. So I think that the name was fitting. Eric Munster, director of TSANAFTRG, which is a big acronym for this overarching collaborative effort to save these turtles, stated, quote, "A thriving alligator snapping turtle population in the heart of the nation's fourth largest city is a unique situation that should not be taken for granted. To reach 100 marked alligator snapping turtles in one ecosystem is a rare feat. It speaks to the dedication of the research group carrying out the work and the integrity of the ecosystem being worked in, as well as the unique ecological role of this environment to Houston and Texas at large." So, it's a really great story. J.J. Watt's involved, turtles are involved, but I think...
I like turtles.
Oh man, that old gif.
I like turtles. But either they get it or they don't.
Yeah, either you do or you don't. But at the end of the day, I think the story really pitches the idea that even if you're living in a huge, bustling, massive city like Houston, conservation and paying attention to your environments are so important. And we need more love for turtles. We need to conserve our waterways and our wetlands to solve this problem, because once the alligator snapping turtles are gone, it's going to be really hard to bring them back. They've been here for thousands of years, and we need to pay homage to them, respect them, and keep them a part of our environment.
Very beautiful story. I love that. And you know, a few weeks ago we had the sea turtle.
Yeah.
A good news story. So we have this one. And at this point, I have to question, would you just like to turn this into a turtle-based podcast? No crime, all turtles.
No crime, all turtles. I love it. I am a huge reptile lover. As you know, we have Asha the Gecko. Mm-hmm. She's part of the Reptile Forensics Unit. Mm-hmm. But if you want to do talking with turtles or talking turtles, I would totally be down for that.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for telling us that beautiful story. We shall see you in just a minute for the after show.
Oh, man, that's an ender.
Hey, y'all. Welcome back to the after show.
The after show.
Whoa. Wow. You scared me. You can find us online on social media. On Twitter, we are at ACNC Podcast. On Instagram, we are at All Crime No Cattle. And on Facebook, you can find us on our discussion page, or you can find us on our discussion group. And that's about it.
Well, except for the fact that you can find me on Instagram at Detective Shea Butter.
Oh, man.
If you want barbecue pictures, I recently posted a throwback picture with me and Jinkos. That is a really awesome sight to see.
Are you just trying to become Instagram famous?
And hey, I'll take all the followers I can get. But yeah, this is the part of the show where we do some shout outs and we pay homage to everybody who supports the show. And if you would like to support the show, you can also go over to patreon.com/allcrimenocattle. We've got a lot of rewards over there for people, a lot of swag you can get. But this is where we talk about our Texas Rangers, which include, in no particular order, Angel Moody, Brandy Doyebi, Brandy Gardner, Kate Williams, Serial Killer Sweets, Chelsea Kennedy, Kobe Gutierrez, Danielle Drollinger, Don Maloney, Emma Jordan, Gail Parker, Haley Ang, House Burke, Jamie Gray, Jessica Layfield, Joanne Cooley, Leah Daugherty, Lynetta Liberto, Lisa Layton, Nigel, Phoebe Southworth, and Sarah Nicholson. Thank you, Texas Rangers. You are a huge part. You're the foundation of this show. They are our special producers. We thank you so much for producing all of these episodes for us. And now we have to do some special shout outs for our newest contributors to the Patreon page. We've got Jen O'Kane, Angie Smith, Shannon H., author Bella Jewell, Brandy Dozier, and Shronda Carter. Thank you guys so much. We appreciate it. We love all of our new patrons. We just put a new Patreon episode out about Mr. Anime, and it was very fascinating. Aaron and I worked on it together jointly, and it went really well. It was very interesting, a tragic, brutal case, but Nonetheless, I think the patrons really enjoyed it, so if you want to check that stuff out, go check it out. Other than that, I don't have anything left, Aaron. We're at the end of the line. The train is pulling into the station. Got anything else?
Isn't it pulling out of the station? Doesn't that make more sense? If we're leaving?
No, we're at the end of the line. We're pulling into the station.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Nope, nothing for me.
Well, all right then. You know what time it is. Always remember, crime is bigger in Texas, y'all. Adios!
Goodbye.
Oh, short and sweet.
Short and sweet.